Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the unusually light sentence handed down last Thursday by a federal judge who, in sentencing Paul Manafort to 47 months, said he had led an otherwise blameless life. Rachel Barco, who is a former member of the U.S. Sentencing Commission and is now a professor of law at NYU, joins us to discuss the glaring disparity between the sentences wealthy white-collar criminals are given compared to the jail time poor minority offenders get. Just 2 weeks ago, a black man in Mississippi was given 12 years in prison for possessing marijuana he bought legally in Oregon, and a public defender in Brooklyn provided context in the Manafort case, pointing to his low-income client, who was offered a 36 to 72-month sentence by prosecutors for stealing $100 worth of quarters from a residential laundry room. And it could be argued that all sentences in the U.S. are too harsh, and that our correctional system, which houses the highest number of prisoners per capita in the world, is also more focused on punishment than rehabilitation. Then, with centrist Democrats nervous that the party is being pulled too far to the left by charismatic young members of the new House, such as the Democratic Socialist Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, we will speak with Bhaskar Sankara, the founder and editor of Jacobin magazine and a columnist for The Guardian, about his new book, The Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in the Era of Extreme Inequality. We will discuss how the Trump 2020 campaign is already weaponizing the slur of socialism, equating the disastrous state in Venezuela with what would happen if Bernie Sanders were to be elected president. And we'll assess the semantic and political difference between social democrats and democratic socialists, and whether socialism is an alternative to capitalism or a means by which capitalism can be improved. Then finally, we will investigate the reasons why intelligence officials took the unusual step of refusing Jared Kushner a top secret clearance, putting their careers on the line in taking a stand against a vindictive president who overruled their objections, prompting the White House chief of staff and the White House counsel to write memos for the record objecting to Trump's move. Robert Baer, a veteran CIA officer who is now a national security analyst at CNN, joins us to discuss the likelihood evidence from intercepts in which Kushner spilled U.S. secrets to his friend Mohammed bin Salman are now in the hands of investigators for committees in the House. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Rachel Barco, who's Vice Dean and Siegel Family Professor of Regulatory Law and Policy, Faculty Director at the Center on the Administration of Criminal Law at New York University. A former member of the United States Sentencing Commission, she is the author of the new book just out, Prisoners of Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rachel Barco.
Much for having me.
So, Rachel, what was your reaction to the sentencing last Thursday of Paul Manafort?
I was definitely surprised at how much below the sentencing guideline range the judge went. It wasn't so surprising that the judge decided to go outside the range, since the recommendation was, you know, more than 19 years in prison, 19 to 24 years. But the extent of the departure, going as low as 4 years, was surprising.
So the recommendations, are those what you and your fellow members of the U.S. Sentencing Commission came up with?
So they're from the Sentencing Guidelines, which is a federal book that gives judges recommended guideline ranges for different federal crimes. And you essentially, as a judge, would go to the book and figure out what a person did, various factors about their crime, whether they accepted responsibility or not, you know, was it a sophisticated crime. And it kind of gives you, almost mathematically, you come at the end of that with a recommended sentencing range. And judges don't have to follow that range because the guidelines are advisory. But judges often do follow the range, or at least use that range as an anchor in setting a sentence. And so in this case, which involved a very high fraud loss amount, the recommended guideline range was quite high because the amount of financial loss was so high, and because, you know, it was a very sophisticated fraud that had taken place over many, many years, and there was no acceptance of responsibility. So, you know, all that taken together gave a recommended range that was quite high. And in many fraud cases, we do see when the amounts are that high that judges often go lower than what the recommended sentence is.
But there's absolutely no mandate here in the work that you've done and in the book that you've provided. In other words, the judge has total discretion.
So the judge has discretion. The government could file an appeal, and so there is a way in which there's some judicial review. But I don't think what the judge did here would fall outside the bounds of what an appellate court would find to be acceptable. So there is some oversight, even in this regime that has advisory sentences, but it does give judges a fair amount of leeway to set the sentence.
And do you think in any way he was influenced by the fact that next week Amy Berman Jackson in the D.C. District Court will be sentencing Manafort on separate charges, two separate charges, each of which have a maximum of 5 years. So he could get 10 years or 5 years concurrently. And I'm not entirely sure whether that is in addition to the almost 4 years that Judge Ellis handed down.
Right. So we don't know yet whether, in Judge Jackson's case, whether she'll decide to impose her sentence on top of it or have them run at the same time or concurrently. That'll be a decision up to her next week. In terms of what we saw in Judge Ellis's case, it's hard to know exactly why he departed as low as he did, and if he shouldn't have been anticipating the sentence next week. That wasn't his charge in his case. He should have given what he thought to be an appropriate sentence based on the crimes that he had before him. So, you know, if that was what was a motivator there, you know, that wouldn't be an appropriate one. And he didn't say that that's what he was doing. You know, instead it seemed to be that he didn't think the crimes were as serious as the government thought they were, that a lot of outside observers have thought them to be. You know, he seemed to have some sympathy for Manafort and characterize him as having lived an otherwise blameless life, you know, which is a bit hard to square with the facts in the case. This was a very long fraud. It wasn't as if this was something kind of a one-off that took place over a matter of days. You know, this is a decade's worth of fraudulent activity at the highest dollar amount levels, you know, in addition to the accusations in the other case that he was, you know, that he thinks he pleaded guilty to. So it's hard to understand that characterization of an otherwise blameless life, but it seemed to be that he had some sense that this was someone who didn't deserve a sentence that was that high.
And again, I'm speaking with Rachel Barkow, who's a Vice Dean and Siegel Family Professor of Regulatory Law and Policy Faculty Director at the Center on the Administration of Criminal Law at New York University. She's a former member of the United States Sentencing Commission, and she's the author of the new book just out, Prisoners of Politics. So let's talk about the subject of your book, Prisoners of Politics, because this feels very political. And, of course, people immediately, when these sentences come down that seem favorable to say, in this case of Manafort, of course, he was a Republican operative. There's no two ways about it. And the campaign chair and director of the Republican candidate who won the presidency, Donald Trump. So immediately people said, oh, he was appointed by Ronald Reagan, and somehow that explains it all. But what to your mind explains it? And is there evidence, for example, of the disparity that we're talking about in the case of Judge Ellis? Has he given, say, minority offenders stiff sentences in comparison to the fact that that Manafort, who, by the way, defrauded the American people of $55 million of taxes that he should have paid on income that he squirreled away offshore, $55 million. I mean, that is an extraordinary amount of money, and that means the rest of us are getting stiffed by default. So, you know, it's pretty hard to understand why the judge did what he did. But is there evidence that he has also exhibited a lack of fairness?
Well, I would say we could look at what he did as reflecting a broader set of trends in America that we see in sentencing, which is it is just a fact that we see wealthier white defendants getting lighter sentences than poorer people of color. And there's data to back that up, and we could ask many questions as to why that is. In the case of Judge Ellis and his past sentencing practices, we do have examples of him giving out quite long sentences in cases involving black defendants, but in those cases, his hands were tied by mandatory minimum sentences that Congress had passed. And so when there's a mandatory minimum sentence involved, judges don't have the same discretion that we were talking about earlier. They have to impose at least that sentence. So it's a little apples to oranges comparison if we were to try to get a sense. What we really want to know is, when he has discretion, what is Judge Ellis doing? And I haven't seen an analysis of his cases to know that. I could tell you that when we look overall at federal judges, we do see disparities between defendants who are white and defendants who are black, all else being equal. So same crimes, same criminal history, there is that disparity. And, you know, there's a variety of reasons that might account for that, including which defendants do judges sympathize with more or relate to more. There may be all kinds of problems with that. One thing I do want to caution against, though, is sometimes when the public is outraged by a lenient sentence or something like a case like this, you know, there's a tendency to then want to tie judges' hands in the future or make the sentences for everyone much higher. And, you know, that is pretty much how we end up in America with the highest incarceration rate in the world. It's just this dynamic where some outlier crime or sentence gets people really upset, and then they end up passing these really sweeping laws that apply to a whole range of people well beyond who they originally had in mind. You know, people might have Paul Manafort in mind when they're outraged here, but if ultimately some kind of a law gets passed, inevitably it's going to get applied to people that aren't like him. You know, it's probably also going to be applied against more likely people who are downtrodden and get caught up in the system. So I do think we have a politics here that tends to favor wealthier defendants with better defense counsel to make better arguments, who are more sympathetic on net to judges. The problem is, when we've tried to equalize in the past, what we've ended up doing is just making sentences more severe for everyone. And when we've made them more severe, it still has tended to fall disproportionately on communities of color.
So is there any evidence that Judge Ellis has given harsh sentences to poorer and perhaps minority offenders in tax avoidance, as opposed to $55 million worth of tax avoidance, which is pretty extraordinary in the case of Manafort?
So I haven't seen that. I did see that he mentioned, Judge Ellis mentioned, another case he had involving similar kinds of financial frauds where he also gave a much lower sentence. So his argument was that in cases like the one he had before him with Manafort, he had departed before, and in fact, in his district, sentences had been lower. So he thought one of the reasons why he should give a lower sentence to Manafort was because that actually was the practice in his district and in his court, was in cases like that to lower the sentence. And it is also true nationwide, when we look at the statistics in fraud cases that involve really high loss amounts, that can get your guideline sentence up very quickly. And so it's in those cases that we do see judges often going below the guideline range. Here, what I would say is unique is not that he went below the guidelines, but by how much. You know, I think going below 19 years was not remotely surprising here, but going as far down as 4 years was. And it's hard to find a comparable case like this one where that departure was as steep as the one that Judge Ellis gave.
Well, obviously, the concern is here that, you know, justice is blind. We know that, and that's the whole point. Justice being blind with a blindfold and the scales is the idea that everybody can get their day in court and be fairly judged. But when these cases like Manafort come up, and outraging, I think, the vast majority of the population, and it engenders a kind of disrespect for the law, and that does lasting damage, surely.
It does. I mean, and I think the question is, you know, what do you do about it? And, you know, there's two options, which is either you treat everybody as harshly as possible, which, you know, I've seen calls for that. But, you know, I would urge people to consider the alternative, which is that everybody should get treated as well as we are treating the wealthy, well-counseled defendants in our society, that we should be looking at the sentences we're giving in these other cases where someone's stealing $100 worth of quarters and getting 5 years, or they're committing a drug crime and they're getting 10 years. Those sentences are just too high. And because they're so high, when we have a case like this one that involves more criminal conduct, you know, it's out of whack. And so the question is, which way do you fix it? And I would just really hope that overall we just reconsider the way in which we've made sentences so high for so many things in America that we dial things down for everyone.
Well, this particular case is a challenge because I'm sure a lot of people we know that from the polls, that a lot of people are very unhappy with President Trump and would like to see him voted out or otherwise removed from office. And by extension, what we learned about Manafort is pretty sleazy, and it may be infinitely worse that he may well have been for decades an asset of the Kremlin. So on the one hand, you know, this is a pretty disgraceful human being. But on the other hand, he's an elderly man who there's a certain bloodlust out there amongst, you know, mostly sort of progressive and liberal commentators that he should get more time in jail. And I just find that, you know, people are falling into a trap. Progressives should be the ones that are really in favor of lighter sentences and more rehabilitation and less punishment.
Yeah, it's hard. People get clouded. You know, we all do. There's certain crimes, I think, that we all just have reactions to where the punishment just seems so light that it just doesn't seem to show respect for the law or justice or equality. And then when you get upset about that, it's, you know, it's very hard to put those emotions in check and really think about, okay, but how should I deal with other cases? Or in general, what should our policies be? Because you're just so clouded by the emotional reaction to one particular case. I will say with this one, the sentences aren't over yet for him, though. And as you pointed out, there's going to be another sentencing this week. And the only crimes that Judge Ellis had were those tax fraud and bank fraud, you know, lying on loan applications. That was the only thing that he had before him in his courtroom. But we are going to see the obstruction of justice claims in the D.C. courtroom this weekend in that sentence. And I would guess that the result of that is he will get more prison time. And I think he will either get more prison time because this sentence is going to be longer, but it may run concurrently with Judge Ellis's sentence, or she's going to decide to put her sentence on top of his. But either way, I suspect it won't be 4 years that he is left with. So I think people who are angry about his particular sentence should at least stay tuned, because I think we're not done with him yet. But, you know, more broadly still, I wish people had the same level of outrage and emotion when someone's given a sentence that's excessively harsh, because that's happening in courtrooms around America every single day. You know, there was a woman who got a 5-year sentence for voting because she didn't realize, because of her felony record, that she wasn't allowed to vote. You know, I mean, that's insane. You know, there are people who are given 10-year sentences for dealing small amounts of drugs, often a drug like marijuana that's legal in some places now. So I do think if people had the same level of outrage when sentences were too harsh, we wouldn't necessarily have the mass incarceration that we do right now in America.
Well, just in closing, when we talk about disrespect for the law, what's your reaction? What would your reaction be if Donald Trump pardoned Manafort?
I think if we thought we'd seen outrage with the judicial sentence, we wouldn't have seen anything yet. Because I do think a pardon in this case would be inappropriate for a whole host of reasons. The criminal activity is blatant. There's no dispute about it. You know, he pleaded to many of the crimes that he has committed, so he's admitted that he's done them. There's been no acceptance of responsibility, any kind of indication of remorse or apology of any kind whatsoever. It was, as you said, defrauding the American people out of tax dollars that, you know, hardworking people in this country pay their taxes. I pay my taxes. So the idea of pardoning someone who hasn't done that, who thinks the rules are for everybody else but not for him, would be outrageous. And I do think the reaction to it would be, you know, quite harsh. And also, I think if he did do that, you know, again, it would be, unfortunately, there's a lot of people out there who do deserve pardons, who do deserve clemency, but you give it to someone like Manafort, it makes a mockery of the entire fact that we have clemency. And so, you know, in addition to producing an unjust result in Manafort's case, I fear it would call into question the use of clemency for the people who really deserve it.
Well, Rachel Bacow, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Rachel Bacow, who's Vice Dean and Siegel Family Professor of Regulatory Law and Policy Faculty Director at the Center on the Administration of Criminal Justice at New York University. She's a former member of the United States Sentencing Commission, and she's the author of the new book just out, Prisoners of Politics. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how centrist Democrats are nervous that the party's being pulled too far to the left by Democratic Socialists such as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Are you really for peace and equality? Or when my car's hooked up, you know you want to follow me. Your laws are minimal, because you won't even think about looking at the real criminal. This has got to cease, because we be getting hyped to the sound of the police. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound.
Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Bhaskar Sankara, who is the founder and editor of Jacobin Magazine and a columnist for The Guardian. He has written for The New York Times, Le Monde, and The Washington Post, and is the author of the brand new book, The Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality. And his latest article at The Guardian is Bernie Sanders Got Personal Last Week, and It Paid Off. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bhaskar Sankara.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. And there is a big article in Sunday's New York Times about how centrist Democrats are nervous that the party's being pulled too far to the left by charismatic young members of the new House, such as the Democratic Socialist Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Is that a portent, Bhaskar, of a kind of train wreck here where the progressive Democrats and the more centrist ones are going to go to war against each other, and the perfect will become the enemy of the good, and Donald Trump will walk into a re-election in 2020?
Well, I think it's very funny that there is a group of people who call themselves centrist and that who will always be in their mind centrist, even when you're at the point today when the majority of Americans support the Green New Deal, including a majority of Republicans. A majority of Americans, including close to majority of Republicans, support Medicare for all. People support measures like job guarantees, a living wage, the right to join a union. There has been a shift in U.S. politics, spurred in part by Bernie Sanders, in part by AOC and all these new politicians, in part because of this wave of teacher strikes that have been so inspiring, and I know just hit California, both Oakland and Los Angeles. And I find it funny that the mainstream of the Democratic Party still believes that they have their finger on the pulse of what ordinary Americans want. And, of course, they call themselves centrist, but the center has, in fact, shifted in this more progressive direction. So I think, in fact, the policies being pursued, like Medicare for All, by this new wave of leftward-moving Democrats and those who are independents, like Bernie Sanders, many of them call themselves Democratic Socialists, is, in fact, more mainstream than the so-called mainstream politicians think.
Well, how then do you compare the Green New Deal to H.R. 1, which is the House just passed this extraordinarily sweeping piece of legislation that would clean up American politics in the most radical way. It's not aspirational. It's actually clear. Of course, the Republicans want nothing to do with it because it ends corruption. It's about making voting easier. It's about stopping voter suppression. It's about empowering and enabling people to easily vote on a public holiday. It is probably the most progressive piece of legislation ever to pass the House in decades, and yet nobody's paying it any attention. But they are talking about the Green New Deal.
Oh, I think it's quite important. And I think those reforms go a long way towards building the conditions in which we can actually have a coalition to change American politics. Because simply without political reform, without voting reform, it's going to be extremely difficult to take this progressive majority that I was just describing and turn it into actual progressive votes and actual progressive legislation. So I do think that's an important step. Now, I think the main goal of the left and the main thing that something like the Green New Deal has done, and more importantly, and I think the Medicare for All has been doing, is take ideas and make a kind of oppositional movement that doesn't necessarily write new legislation so much as, of course, there is legislation attached to all these things, so much as change the conditions in which legislation is written. So I would guess that House Democrats would be less bold in passing that kind of legislation if there wasn't space that was opening up to the left of them. So I think the relationship between the two is quite symbiotic.
Well, but one of the things that has distracted us from H.R. 1, which again has not been getting the attention it deserves, has been these arguments where the House Democratic Caucus has been wrangling over anti-Semitism versus Islamophobia. And, of course, the Republicans are loving it. And when you have Representatives Omar and Tlaib getting them all in a lather over reckless remarks that they make, doesn't that distract from the agenda that we're trying to get?
Well, I personally don't think the remarks were reckless. I think the response was overblown. I think most of the problem rests on with the people who were making this into a big controversy. Now, I think that you're talking about a piece of legislation that passed the House and has no chance of passing the Senate. Moreover, it was the fault of House Democrats that they phrase this and conceptualize this as a single piece of legislation, not as part of a broader political case. So it's not surprising that it's not gripping people the way that Medicare for All, Green New Deal, and these other cases that is built fundamentally in a moral sense of fairness in kind of a broader political term, and also is, again, about putting these oppositional ideas into the mainstream, not so much as passing one particular piece of legislation in a congressional session. So I'm not surprised, and again, I don't actually think that there's been a lot of, I think a lot of these controversies are largely media events, to be honest, and I'm not sure how much they're actually penetrating to most American voters. I think almost all of them will be forgotten by the time people vote in 2020. And I do believe that obviously you need a unity of some sort of progressive majority in order to get something passed. But the question is a unity on what basis, especially when we haven't even gotten to the primaries yet. I would imagine that the next crop of Democratic leaders in the House of Representatives and in the Senate will be considerably to the left of the ones we have now by the time we're actually able to pass something like Medicare for All. And I think there needs to be an important battle that happens in the Democratic primaries, with the presidential primary and local primaries. And, you know, I think that battle can actually be bad for some existing members of the House of Representatives who are Democrats, but in fact good for the party as a whole and good for the nation as a whole. And, you know, I don't want to belabor the point, but we could give the example of the Tea Party, for instance, and the idea that, you know, of course I find the Tea Party odious, I oppose everything they stand for, but you can look at what the Tea Party did and say they didn't destroy the Republican Party. In fact, they strengthened the Republican Party. They laid the groundwork for what became Trump. At the same time, you know, when they were making their insurgency within the party, there was plenty of mainstream Republicans who really thought it was going to spell not just the doom of their own personal careers, but the doom of the party as a whole.
And again, I'm speaking with Bhaskar Sankara, who is the founder and editor of Jacobin Magazine and a columnist for The Guardian. He has written for The New York Times, Le Monde, and The Washington Post, and is the author of the brand new book, The Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality. And his latest article at The Guardian is Bernie Sanders Got Personal Last Week, and it paid off. But is there a way for the Democrats to be able to encompass the needs of these centrist Democrats who won in purple and red states and who ran on a more conservative platform simply because there was no way a liberal platform would have penetrated? At least that's the conventional wisdom. On the other hand, you've got, I mentioned Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is in a pretty safe Democratic district. So is that a reality that you can deal with, that some progressives have the luxury of being progressive because they're living in progressive districts, but others, more centrist Democrats, don't have the luxury of being too progressive because their constituents are much more conservative?
I disagree with that conventional wisdom, and I think if you look at the results of the midterm election, you would see that, in fact, generic Democrats just tended to beat the Republican ticket. So what I mean is that people were voting for Democrats, no matter whether they were on the progressive side of the party or the centrist side of the party, because they really wanted Trump out. And I think there's no conclusive evidence that even in some of these districts in which more conservative Democrats won, they wouldn't have won if they were more progressive. And even, I will admit, even in the other direction, that in some of these more progressive Democrats wouldn't have won against a Republican candidate if they were more conservative. So I think that result is pretty inconclusive, that we can see that voters really just want a change, and they are repudiating Trump's agenda. Now, the other thing I would say is that at least Bernie Sanders' agenda, the rhetoric around the Sanders campaign, has in fact been more competitive around self-described moderates and people in red states and purple states. So this sounds counterintuitive, but the way I think of it is there's a whole segment of Americans who identify as moderates. And to them, being a moderate doesn't mean they agree with the opinion page of the Washington Post. It means that they don't like the liberal establishment. They don't like what's been going on and what's been called liberalism for a while, or they feel like it hasn't addressed their needs. They certainly don't like conservatives. They don't, you know, fall in with this Trump agenda. So they call themselves moderates. They call themselves independents. Now, a lot of these people voted for Sanders in 2016. Well, if we're thinking of this in the way, you know, people like me and you, you know, focus a lot on politics, think about it, we would say, well, that's kind of counterintuitive in that, you know, Sanders is clearly on the left wing, to the left of the Democratic Party as a whole, but he's getting the votes of these people who self-describe in the center. But I think it's just simply because he represents something fresh and different, a new sort of politics that people are looking for. And once we get beyond just these ideological labels, if you actually come to what people are thinking about, Medicare for all, you know, the idea that everybody deserves a decent job and that job should be enough to support a family, you know, these things are quite mainstream. So I'm not worried about Democrats being forced to the left in primaries and that jeopardizing their chances in the general election. I do think there's some rhetoric that's used by some people on the liberal left that could be alienating. So, for example, there's a sort of academic discourse around intersectionality and these other things that have been brought up that I think just people just simply don't understand. I think if you boil it down to the basics of people shouldn't be racist, people should respect one another, we all should be given equal opportunities, the majority of Americans would be on board with that. But I think there is a sort of a bunch of buzzwords that we tend to use on the left, and we know what we mean, but in fact are kind of foreign and alien to a lot of regular voters in general elections.
So given that the Republicans and the Trump 2020 campaign is already weaponizing the slur socialism, equating the disastrous state in Venezuela to what would happen if Bernie Sanders were to be elected president, what is the difference between social Democrats and democratic socialists? Is it semantic or is it political?
Well, I think that we come from the same movement. I myself consider myself a democratic socialist. My goal today is to build a broad, expansive welfare state, which means that there are certain things in life that are currently accidents of birth. You know, you could be born into an upper middle class family and have access to your health insurance and access to good public schools and whatever else, but you could be born 30 miles away in an area with terrible schools, no jobs, and no hope. And just through that accident of birth, it shapes the rest of your life outcome. Democratic socialists think that's unfair. Social Democrats would agree. I think democratic socialists have this broader aspiration of going beyond eventually just the welfare state and thinking about new forms of ownership. So we'll ask questions like, could we in fact run our firms, our companies as cooperatives? Can we run it with worker ownership, worker control? Do we have to have bosses in the way we have it now? Political democracy is a good thing in the voting booth. Is it not a good thing in the workplace too? So we'll ask these deeper questions, these questions that I think question capitalist ownership and the kind of what we see as the undemocratic rule by big companies in society. And social democrats often don't ask the same questions, or at least nowadays social democrats don't ask the same questions. I think for the sake of the kind of political coalition we'll need for the next 20, 30 years, you know, a lot of these broader, deeper questions won't even be on the table. But I would say the key difference is we need a politics, like the politics of Bernie Sanders, I would say, that actually involves conflict. So it's not enough to say we should all have universal health care. This is something we should all agree as a society that is a good thing that people deserve as a social right. That shouldn't be something held hostage to the market, to the ability to pay. But also we need to go further than that and say that people benefit from having private health insurance. And the people that benefit are a small minority. These are the health insurance CEOs. They're people employed at the top levels of this industry. And if we're going to make this reform, we need to fight these people. So for Sanders, it's fighting the millionaires and billionaires to achieve change. And I think that conflict is really important. And that conflict and polarization and speaking to people's anger and directing that anger at millionaires and billionaires, that's new to American politics in the last few years, or at least it was dead for a long time, and now it's back. And I think that's what differentiates Sanders and some of these other Democrats.
Well, indeed, and you wrote about this in your piece in The Guardian, Bhaskar Sankara, Bernie Sanders' speech recently at the Brooklyn College, where he pointed out that his entire family was wiped out by the Nazis during the Holocaust. He emigrated at the age of 17 to the U.S. without a nickel in his pocket. He became a paint salesman. They lived in a very small rent-controlled apartment in Brooklyn. His mother always dreamed of having a house of her own, and both his parents died young while still living in this rent-controlled apartment. And it was very touching. Obviously, the tragedy there is that Bernie's parents never lived to see what became of him. And, you know, his path is pretty impressive, from a lone voice in the House of Representatives to an important political figure in the United States.
Yeah, and I think it's something we could all relate to. I mean, I'm the youngest of five, and I'm the only one in my family born in the United States. So I saw how much of what I was able to do. I actually graduated from college the same year as my mother. My mother went back to school late in life. You know, I saw how much of that was based on the sacrifice of others, but also how much of it's based on society. You know, I had the benefit of living in an area, my parents rented an area with good public schools. I had the benefit of having teachers and guidance counselors and others and says, you know, maybe you should take the SAT and, you know, you could go to college. And, you know, if you don't have money to pay for college, you know, you could go somewhere, you could probably get a scholarship. That kind of stuff is what Sanders benefited from. And I think the thrust of his program isn't, you know, the state's going to do everything for you. It's that there are certain things that aren't your fault and then you shouldn't have to worry about. And the state should create the conditions in which you could reach your own potential. And the rest of it, you know, a lot of it's up to you. Working hard, that's up to you. Having and building character and virtue, you know, there's a personal things. But I think in the United States, we've been trained so long and such an individualistic mindset of thinking that every triumph just belongs to us and every defeat just belongs to us. And I think a big part of our message in the next few years has to be talking to, you know, regular working Americans and saying, it's not your fault. You know, if you're unemployed, if you're suffering from medical debt or student debt, like, it's not this big calamity that's your fault. You've been put in a situation. You've been playing a game where you've been, you know, almost destined to lose. And in fact, we could rewrite the rules of the game so you have a fair shot. And I think this is a very important message, and it's in Sanders' program. To some degree, it's also in Elizabeth Warren's program, who I think is the second most, you know, progressive candidate in the field, who's bringing forward a lot of interesting ideas. And it's exciting that these people are out there because, you know, it really wasn't the case that this was the dominant thrust of Democratic primaries in years before. And, you know, as you know, in international context, in fact, it's quite common to have Democratic Socialists as part of the political spectrum putting forward these ideas. In the United States, we just had none of it for so many decades. And now that we finally have Bernie and AOC and people like this, it's completely fresh and new. It's almost anti-establishment, what would be conventional left-to-center politics and much of the rest of the industrial world.
Well, just in closing, Vasquez Quintecara, is socialism an alternative to capitalism, or is it a means by which capitalism can be improved? I don't know whether you saw Governor Hickenlooper being interviewed, I think it was on Morning Joe, where he couldn't give an answer to the question, do you believe in capitalism? To my mind, capitalism is a fact. It's not an ideology.
I think capitalism is certainly a fact of how our society is structured today. And the goal of democratic socialism is to expand democracy and to take certain spheres of life, like healthcare, like education, like childcare, like housing, out of the sphere of the market, where the ability to pay means everything, and enjoy the social rights. So it's meant to erode capitalism. Now, will we ever be able to construct a socialism after capitalism? I would argue that we'll eventually have to think about it. And here's the reason why. It's simply because even if you build up the power of working people within capitalism, capitalists always have a last weapon they could use as a last resort, and that's the ability to withhold investment. So in other words, every new business started in society today, all these new jobs that are created by big corporations and business people. Now, in order to have a functioning society in which we each have the same stake in society, we each have a democratic say, I think we need an alternative where working people can band together and can cooperatively run their own workplaces. Otherwise, the small minority of people, if they don't like what's going on politically, if they don't like our choices in the voting booth, can say, I'm sorry, we're just not going to invest. You're going to either vote the way you want to vote and have a welfare state and unemployment, or you're going to, you know, follow my path. So if we're concerned about democracy, if we want people to be on a level playing field, at least at the level of power, not necessarily results, then I think we need to think about going beyond, you know, capitalism. I think for now, our struggle in the next 10, 20, 30 years is going to largely be about humanizing capitalism and not necessarily going beyond it.
Well, Vasquez Quintecara, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
For having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Vasquez Quintecara, who is the founder and editor of Jacobin Magazine and a columnist for The Guardian. He has written for The New York Times, Le Monde, and The Washington Post, and is the author of the brand new book, The Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality. And his latest article at The Guardian is Bernie Sanders Got Personal Last Week, and It Paid Off. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into why the intelligence community denied Jared Kushner a top secret clearance.
Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing.
Listen, do you want to know a secret? Do you promise not to tell? Whoa, whoa, closer. whisper in your ear. Say the words you long to hear. I'm in love with you. I've known a secret for the...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history, the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. And he's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is an intelligence and national security affairs analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Ian, it's good to be back.
Well, thank you. And the fact that these career intelligence officials stuck their neck out, took a stand against a very vindictive president who overruled their objections against giving Jared Kushner a top secret clearance. My understanding about government bureaucrats is that they don't. They don't take on the president and the commander-in-chief. They're not interested in destroying their careers. So for them to take a stand in this case, there's got to be something behind this. This is obviously, to these people inside the intelligence community, this is a very serious issue.
Well, Ian, you have to understand how rare it is for somebody with political weight to be turned down for security clearance. You remember the Hill, the intelligence committees, and this, the Senate and the House, and all of these people have, business entanglements or foreign entanglements, but they never get turned down. I mean, it has to be something blatant, because the people in the Office of Security at the CIA and the CIA, very conservative. They're, as you know, there's no deep state, so they're very, very conservative, and I wouldn't be surprised if the majority of them voted against Hillary Clinton and voted for Trump. So there's no political motivation. But in order to turn down the son-in-law of the president, it has to be flagrant. And that is that has to be something that is done untrustworthy in terms of national security. And that would be sending an email or on the phone with a foreigner disclosing sensitive secrets. My wife used to work for the Office of Security. We know how it works. You and I could be turned down on minor reasons for security clearance, but somebody at the White House, it's pretty much a given that they're giving a top secret clearance, a given.
Right. Well, this prompted, of course, the White House Chief of Staff, General Kelly, and the White House Counsel, Don McGahn, to write memos for the record objecting to Trump's move and making sure it goes into the historical record that they opposed Trump's move. So that in itself is pretty unusual, isn't it?
Never heard of it. And I would be surprised if it's ever occurred where the chief of staff takes on the president in writing. What you have to understand, Ian, is that Jared Kushner disclosed, as I just said, very, very sensitive information to a foreigner. If he gets on, let's just hypothetically, he got on the phone and called a friend and said, guess what I heard? It's not the end of the world, but it's when you go to a hostile foreign government, let's say Russia or even Saudi Arabia, and giving up secrets like that, that's grounds to turn down a security clearance. And while I don't know the details, I would be willing to bet that's what happened, that they caught him on an intercept giving up secrets.
Well, they apparently already caught him on intercepts back, I think it was December the 10th or 12th of 2016, after Trump's election. He met secretly with Kislyak and the head of the VNB Bank, otherwise known as Putin's slush fund, where two things happened. One, he asked Kislyak, the the Russian ambassador for a secret back channel between the White House and the Kremlin. That's pretty amazing in itself. And then apparently he turned to the VNB banker and said, by the way, I've got a building at 666 Fifth Avenue that's $1.2 billion underwater and I desperately need $500 million. Could you write me a check? At which point the Russians could not believe what they were hearing. The fact that we know that and that Mueller knows that must come from intercepts, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they don't make a record of this unless it's firsthand. Now, clearly, Kislyak didn't disclose this to the government. So it had to have been the Russians calling back to Moscow and saying, you can't believe what we heard coming out of the president's son-in-law's mouth. You won't believe it. I mean, that the Russians are not completely disciplined, especially an ambassador. And they were worrying this is some sort of bizarre trap or something, but clearly, and then there's also the question of the State Department meets princes and businessmen in Riyadh and Jeddah who don't like Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto ruler, the deputy crown prince, and talk out of school about him. Now, the rumor is out there in the press, and this is totally believable for me, that he simply disclosed who those princes were and the businessman. And I have to ask the question, is that one of the reasons they were arrested and brought to the Ritz Hotel and tortured? That's how serious it is. This has never occurred in American history since Benedict Arnold.
So in other words, Jared Kushner is likely to have given his friend Mohammed bin Salman a list of dissident, uh-huh, or even just mildly critical Saudi billionaires, all of whom, hundreds of whom were scooped up. Some of them are still, by the way, in prison or under house arrest, like the crown prince, the guy that was supposed to be the next king.
Well, it's not just that, Ian. There's an American citizen that's right, being held and tortured. Was he, you know, rounded up in this Jared compromise? I don't know. Clearly, I don't know. You have to get that right.
Right.
I just know that the CIA and the National Security Agency and so forth and the military do not turn down the clearances of the son-in-law of the president unless they have a smoking gun. It's the way it happens.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history, the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's considered the foremost authority on the Middle East and is an intelligence and national security affairs analyst for CNN. And so I've heard that happened is that the NSA did these intercepts, particularly on MBS. They clearly have a lot of information from MBS's, either his phone or other phones, that came into play during the Khashoggi investigation of the murder and dismemberment of the Washington Post reporter. So we know that they've been monitoring MBS. So my understanding is that they do have intercepts with Jared Kushner and MBS where U.S. secrets are disclosed. And that these intercepts are in the hands of the Democratic House Committee investigators. So we'll see whether that rumor pans out. But the fact that
on, this you know, this administration has broken so many laws inconsistently and been so hostile to the intelligence community, and the guy's still in the White House. You just don't know where it's going to go. I mean, you know. Frankly, maybe I'm getting old, but this is just incredible. If I get on the phone, call a hostile government, whether it's MBS or Russia, and give up secrets, the definition of that is treason. And this is what we're looking at with Jared Kushner.
Well, we know that he's been running around the world using his status as a special envoy, particularly a special envoy to Middle East peace, which is obviously yet to be realized. That, first of all, I mentioned earlier the meeting in December of 2016 with the Russian ambassador and the head of the Putin slush fund bank. They turned him down. The Chinese insurance company turned him down. The government of Qatar turned him down. And that, in 2 weeks later, they MBS blockaded Qatar after Jared had been turned down for $500 million for his to bail out 666 Fifth Avenue. 666 Fifth Avenue has been bailed out. We understand, but do we know where the money comes from?
We don't know. There's certainly a lot of rumors out there. Saudi Arabia in particular. I don't know about any Russian rumors, but there's certainly accusations out in the financial community that he was bailed out by Saudi Arabia through couple shelf companies. You know, that's what the House should be looking into. And getting to the bottom of it is doable if you're serious. But remember, Mueller's mandate was not to go after Saudi corruption. I mean, we know the Saudis and the UAE paid indirectly for the inaugural. I mean, this is bribery. Plain and simple.
That's their MO, the Saudis. They buy Washington. They buy senior officials. The minute they retire, they give them some nonsensical job, some sinecure. I mean,
in the past, it's been more subtle that, you know, you left, let's say, the State Department and then went for a think tank and had a chair that sort of, you know, painted over Saudi Arabia's faults. And there was a bit of subtlety to it and hard to pin down. This is something entirely different. This is a new level of corruption, which I don't know. We haven't seen since Harding or Grant or somebody. I don't know. I don't know what it's like.
Well, already we have the president lying about it, saying he never intervened. And that goes in the face of the New York Times' reporting. And my understanding is that both McGahn and the chief of staff have verified that they did indeed write memos for the record saying they did not approve of what the president ordered them to do, giving clearance to Jared Kushner. Also, recently, Jared Kushner's wife, the president's daughter, Ivanka, she also appeared to have lied as well, saying that that the president never intervened in the matter of security clearance. Substance of that.
Well, Ian, wait a minute. Have you ever told, you know, how often do they tell the truth?
Yeah, I guess that should be
like
the metric.
A broken clock.
Yeah, that should be the metric, not the thousands of times they lie. It should be, you know, when Trump does tell the truth, it should be a major media event.
A major event. We should have a national holiday for every time he tells the truth.
So I was amused that Anderson Cooper at CNN asked rhetorically the other day, what does Ivanka Trump actually do? She's got a top secret clearance too. We know the Saudis early in the administration, during the transition, I think it was, they gave Salman himself, the king, gave Ivanka Trump $100 million donation to her foundation. Two questions. What does she do in the White House and what does her foundation do?
We don't know. It's like the Trump Foundation. It's a front. It's a scam. But why should we think it's any different? That it spends money marginally usefully. Why would we think that?
Right.
I mean, you just look at the Trump Foundation. You look at his university, and it's a scam.
Well, she's getting off lightly then, because a lot of people think that she's actually different from her father. But my understanding is that she's just as crooked and just as ruthless.
I'm sure she doesn't know better, you know, growing up in that house.
Right.
You know, what would you ever know?
Right. So is your sense then about Mueller, just in the last minute and a half, do you think that I mentioned in an earlier interview that I think the Mueller report's going to be underwhelming and disappoint a lot of people who think it's going to be the magic bullet to get rid of Trump. What's your sense of... Because you know that much of what Mueller's done is from the intelligence world that you belong to. There's a big difference between intelligence work and a legal indictment or the evidence necessary to indict somebody.
Well, yeah, I mean, the assumption in the intelligence community is that he's an unwitting pawn of the KGB and was since 87. But the problem is that to get an indictment for espionage, you need to actually catch him in the act of passing secrets. and not as president, but before. And of course, he didn't have secrets. So Mueller is dealing in a gray area. And in order, he just simply can't come out and say, I think he's an unwitting stooge of the Russians. He just can't say that. He's a lawyer. He's head of the FBI. And the FBI standards for an indictment are much higher than the intelligence. But everybody sort of knows. You look at the complexity of this and the totality of it, and he, in effect, is a Russian agent. I mean, everything he's done, you know, from the Cleveland platform to his statements and his private meetings with Putin. You know, I mean, right. that's as a former intelligence officer, that's what it looks to me.
Right.
But in the FBI and the Department of Justice would never bring an indictment based on their assumptions and looking at overall what he's done. They can't do it.
Well, Robert Baer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is an intelligence and national security affairs analyst for CNN. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
With a man she loved, standing along the side.